the reason why I was wrong in my assessment previously, but the reason why I stayed bullish was because I think like 1010 did break the market psychology in a way that you did hit kind of seller exhaustion, especially in February.
André Dragos is a German finance expert with 10 plus years in portfolio management and research.
And a crypto investor since 2014, specializing in institutional crypto since 2018.
We essentially front ran like 1.5 years of quantum discount in like 5 months. Because if Bitcoin implemented quantum resistant addresses in 2026 already, we will probably close that discount in an instant, which implies already 50% upside just by closing this kind of quantum discount. Just hypothetically speaking, we are seeing the biggest macro discount on record for Bitcoin.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today I'm pleased to have André Dragos back on the show. He has been the first guest ever to join this Less Noise, More Signal show when we started about, yeah, it's probably a little more than a year ago. And it's great to have you back, André.
Thanks again. Yeah, happy to be here and congratulations on the development of your show. Yeah, I'm a frequent listener as well.
Yes, we've been trying to push the envelope. It's been hard, you know, like you want to get to talk to people. And one thing that I've been recognizing is just like reaching out to people has become ever harder with the entire AI slop thing, you know, that I feel like I hear people are being flooded with emails from India, Pakistan, and Indonesia with sales pitches and stuff. And so your sort of email also kind of gets drowned in all of these emails, you know? And so even with people that I had somewhat of a good relationship with, it's kind of hard to pin them down, you know, because they're not seeing my emails. And then you try to go through a different channel and all of the sudden they're like, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't even see the email. So this is one, maybe for savvy entrepreneurs out there, something to solve, you know, in the age of AI, because people are already on it. But that's one thing that's been making it hard to kind of keep booking the guests. But we're getting there, and it's great to have you back as well.
Thank you. Yeah, Twitter DM is always best, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was just wondering, you know, because like this head of product at Twitter, he posted a couple of days ago that he thinks in 90 days, iMessage, Gmail, and other things, it will be totally unusable, you know? And I feel like I can already see it, you know, because I'm getting so many of these sort of fake AI PR emails, you know, of people wanting to introduce somebody or selling me something. And this has really picked up in the last couple of weeks or months. And he's sort of very skeptical that email won't be usable, which is kind of scary because I really depend on it, you know, trying to fix or schedule episodes with people. So it will be interesting to see if we will have to move to other channels, which probably at some point we already are. No, crazy. Well, I mean, yes, for today's discussion, I think I want to talk about the obviously Bitcoin and we've come a long way now and everything has gone so fast, especially, you know, like back in last summer, everything was still okay. And now we're almost 50% lower price wise and sentiment is really broken, I would assume. And so, yeah, the 4-year cycle once again, like eerily seems to be correct, you know, it's just very eerie how this thing keeps coming back and it just sort of hits again. What is your assessment of everything, you know? Why have we, Is it just a four-year cycle, or is there more to it that Bitcoin has now corrected almost 50% from its all-time high?
Yes, it's the question of questions, but I think it explains also the trajectory of where we're heading, right? But so the way I view it is there are different factors, but let's start with the on-chain first. So if you look at on-chain development, I think it started around the summertime, Q4, right? That you saw these news about like Satoshi era coins hitting the market, right? Being distributed by long-term holders, right? Who held for sometimes more than 10 years, right? And suddenly started to distribute a large chunk of the holdings. Our prime example is Roger Ver himself, right? He dumped like 80,000 Bitcoins, I think. Was it by a Galaxy? I think some kind of crypto merchant as well, OTC. But there was lots of selling by these long-term holders. And you could see it in on-chain data. I think if long-term holder distribution realized profits essentially were around 700,000 Bitcoins, right? Which compared to previous cycles, right, is actually some kind of top cycle top indicator in itself, right? But the reason why I was wrong in my assessment previously, but the reason why I stayed bullish was because institutional demand was at least as big as this long-term holder selling. So you could actually say that there was some kind of redistribution of supply from Bitcoin OGs, long-term holders, right, to these new institutions, which are essentially also long-term holders, right, based on their like acquisition profile, how they distribute, how they accumulate, and so on. And in terms of the halving, I also thought like, and that was actually our official prediction, that the halving cycle is dead, right? The four-year cycle is dead. It became somewhat consensus, right, in hindsight, right? But the reason why we thought it was dead was, if you look at it from a pure quantitative perspective, right, you compare, for instance, institutional demand by treasury companies such as MSCI, Metaplan, and so on, and also ETPs, exchange traded products such as iShares, IBIT, and so on, our product across the whole world, right? The net institutional demand in 2025 was already four times bigger than the halving deficit, the supply deficit induced by the halving, right? Which is around 164,000 Bitcoins per year, right? Less supply that is hitting the market by a minor selling, right? That net institutional demand was above 700,000, right? In 2025 alone. That's why we also thought like that the halving has become less relevant, not irrelevant, right? But definitely less relevant than in previous cycles. Especially, I think it started in 2024 when net institutional demand outsized the halving effect by multiples, right? And 2025 is the same. That's why I thought like, okay, probably less relevant than before. That's why we thought the halving cycle was dead. But in truth, right, if you look at the post-performance patterns of right, we're actually following this median performance pattern to the T, right? We topped in October, which was also implied by previous halving performance patterns, right? Mm. And now we are still following the halving cycle.
Imagine lowering your tax bill while stacking Bitcoin. With Blockware, you can. Thanks to new tax guidelines, you can write off 100% of your mining hardware costs in a single year. Blockware's mining as a service takes care of everything, so you can start mining Bitcoin effortlessly. Visit mining.blockwaresolutions.com/LNMS and get $100 off for your first miner.
I mean, to some degree, it might be true, you know, that the miners, their impact, it's just diminishing just because, relatively speaking, you know, rather than also in absolute terms, it's ever less Bitcoin that they're sort of able to dump onto the markets because they're getting ever less in that sense, you know. But I feel like, it's probably, as you said in the beginning, it's these long-term holders, you know, maybe psychologically are somewhat still tied to the four-year cycle, because I feel like, you're exactly right. You know, they started selling and probably they started selling ever since Trump got elected, you know, in November. And so back then, probably the institutional demand was just able to keep up. But then at some point, it started to overwhelm it, you know, and that's where then prices started to correct it. Because the 80,000 Bitcoin that you mentioned, you know, that was somewhere in summer. And there, a lot of commentators were like, wow, the market is absorbing this enormous sell order and Bitcoin stays, it was around maybe 110 or something, you know? And so already there, people were still like, okay, it can probably absorb it. But then, I mean, that was sort of the precursor to what's to come, you know, because like maybe we kind of exhausted all our options back then. We're still able to sustain it. But then when there was more supply coming onto the market by long-term holders, we weren't. So yeah, that's probably exactly. It, right?
Yeah, I think so too. What you could also see in Q4 was the change in that institutional demand, right? The growth rate was actually decelerating, right? I think Charles Edwards has alluded to this many times. But there was some kind of deceleration. And as you said, at some point, this kind of long-term holder supply distribution overwhelmed that institutional demand, which was also decelerating, right, in Q4. And then you saw like this big price correction, which was also exacerbated by things like 1010, right? The 1010 liquidation that exacerbated the downside and led to even more selling pressure. Because of long squeezes throughout.
Looking back, like in retrospective, would you say this is something most of the people underestimated? Because I feel like we had this 1010 event, we had like a correction of open interest by almost 50%, you know, I guess futures, everything was hit, you know, and then I feel like some people were saying, okay, this will have a very crazy dragging effect, you know, and some people were saying, no, it's okay-ish. And then obviously we saw this immediate crash, but then the market also kind of mean reverted in some extent. But then in November, one of the first like major crashes came. Do you think this was underestimated? And if so, why, you know?
Yeah, I think it was underestimated, right? Especially the degree of long-term holder selling and the degree to how long institutional demand can keep this kind of pace, right? Of buying. But I think like 1010 did break the market psychology in a way that the mentality of investors moved away from buy the dip, right? Towards sell the rips, right? And you can also see it in on-chain data, especially with respect to short-term holders, right? Things like SOPR, which are essentially like the amount of spending above break-even or below break-even, right? And you could see whenever like short-term holders were approaching break-even again in a position of loss, right? They started distributing again, right? So they just wanted to get out of that position, exit their position. Right, when they were underwater. So it was not like this, okay, we have a correction, then we buy the dip. It was more like this kind of sell the rip mentality, which tends to exacerbate a bear market. It's essentially a bear market kind of psychology. But I think you did hit kind of seller exhaustion, especially in February with the on the 5th of Feb, right, when he had like the biggest decline in sentiment, I think since FTX, literally since FTX, our own crypto asset sentiment index, it hit the lowest level since November 2022.
Yeah.
And so I think we did reach some kind of crescendo, some kind of very high degree of seller exhaustion. And I think we could even move lower from here, right? It's quite possible. But I doubt very much that we'll move lower on even more selling, with more selling, right, from short-term holders and even a higher spike in vol and so on, because all these option metrics, they already imply, especially in early February, they've already implied a very significant degree of pain, right? at conversion.
Well, one thing that sort of makes me somewhat positive that there's not that much downside ahead of us is really because we had these two deleveraging events, or like we could even say three. We had one in October, then we had like a panic move in November, you know, where we crashed down to 80K exactly. And then we had like, we were chopping around the true market mean, which I thought would have been a greater support. That's where I was sort of wrong. I expected this to be a support for longer. I thought at some point it might break, but that it would already break in February, I wouldn't have expected. And then when we broke through February, through the 80K in February, I think, that's also where things accelerated and we smashed down to 60K, you know. And this, as you said, it was really this capitulation event, retrospectively speaking again. But then because we had these two very sharp events in such a short time period, this also kind of now makes me a little more positive, as you said, you know, that most of the sellers have already dumped their bags. And now, I think maybe some job solidation ahead, you know, with just like some people that still want to get out. We will get some counter rallies. People will probably sell the rip, as you said, and try to get out, you know, but it will probably just be consolidation around maybe with some slow bleed to 55K or whatever. So, I don't know. Yeah. I would be curious how you see it, you know, developing over the next few weeks or months even.
So I do think we could consolidate for the next 2 to 3 months, because what happens during a bear market is you actually see a kind of transfer of coins, right, from essentially weak hands to stronger hands, right? And in terms of coins being transferred, I think we've transferred around 7 million bitcoins during this bear cycle, right? And usually you see around 10 million coins being transferred in every kind of bear cycle. Right. Based on this kind of rationale alone, we probably have like 3 million coins to be transferred from weak head to strong hands. And this is how you actually form a kind of bottom, right?
Yeah.
You have a more solid foundation going forward. You have like seller extortion in general, right? And I think in terms of the on-chain, what I'm still looking for is even more pain in many metrics, such as like percentage of supply and profit. I think we hit 50%, right? A percentage supply and profit slash loss, right?
Yeah.
On the 5th of Feb. But we only during this day, right? We briefly touched, we went below 50% on an intraday basis. But usually previous bear markets have seen longer periods below 50%, right? More like pain, financial pain, right? But even if you look at things like percentage of addresses in profit, percentage of entities in profit, we haven't seen these kind of like bear market capitulation cycle low levels yet. So I think that there could be still some downside left. But that being said, it's, in my view, it's still very asymmetric, right? In terms of downside risk, especially from the macro side, but we can also talk about this later.
No, I mean, what you're referencing here is like these unrealized gains, you know, that people still have. And I think from what I've seen, usually, we're at 55% or something, you know, of the entire network still having unrealized gains in that sense. And I feel like in prior bear markets, we went down to 40 or 45%, you know, but then I'm wondering, like, everyone is now sharing these numbers again, you know, and everyone is looking for the cycle to play exactly the same, you know, as it did in previous cycles. And obviously you said about the days and the timing, it was pretty eerily correct, you know. But then I'm wondering, couldn't there be some diminishing returns to these downward spirals, you know, just because when you look at the last few cycles, we've always, I think the first cycle was almost 90% correction, then 80, then it was 75, maybe because of the FTX, it could have been 70. So this time around, it might be 60 or maybe even a little lower of bear market correction from all-time high. And so also in terms of unrealized gains, it might just be the case that there's not that much to go lower, just because there are some diminishing effects, you know, because of the institutionalization, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like just like one last point, if we were to go down to these levels again of prior bear markets, the price could potentially be at 45K US dollar, which is not impossible. But I feel like we would probably almost undo the entire ETF pump that we had, you know. And I don't see as of yet why this should be possible. That would be kind of crazy, you know, that like everything would unwind in that sense, you know. For this, yes, more ETF holders would have to sell, I guess. So yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, I think like Bitcoin's maturing, right? Where we have seen this kind of structural decline in volatility. And now realized volatility is probably closer to the S&P 500, NASDAQ, Max 7 stocks, right? Used to be significantly higher. I think in terms of realized volatility, around 30 to 40% right now, right? So that's like a rough rule of thumb. And there's a connection between realized volatility and the drawdown. I think you say it's like twice the volatility, right? So you could definitely see like 60, 70% drawdown, right, based on the current realized vol. But it's true, it has been declining because of institutional adoption, right, and so on. But I do think from the macro side, I do think we're already undershooting so many variables, right? And we could talk about the reasons why we're undershooting them, right? It could be idiosyncratic or it could be some kind of other factor. But I think we just talked about ETP flows, institutional flows, right? If you look at the relationship between Bitcoin and cumulative ETP flows into Bitcoin ETPs, right, worldwide, there's been somewhat of a connection, right? Bitcoin has been following this kind of these cumulative flows all the time. And there's been like overshoots, undershoots. But now we have seen the biggest undershoot on record, right? Like biggest deviation from these cumulative flows. They haven't really declined that much, right? It's still in absolute terms around 100,000 Bitcoins from peak to trough that have flown out of global Bitcoin ETPs. But still, if you did like a simple kind of regression between cumulative Bitcoin ETP flows and the price of Bitcoin, we are 40% undershooting this kind of relationship, right? And so if you assume that like institutional flows are still one of the dominant drivers, so I'd assume if you saw a reacceleration in flows, right, because of rising risk appetite, because of maybe the lagged effects from the US wirehouse approvals, right, because they've just approved the US ETFs in Q4, right? It's not so long ago that most of these major wirehouses, like Bank of America, they approved in December, right? So we could see these kind of lagged flows into ETFs. And you're every time you see a net inflow day, like Bitcoin shoots up by 5%, right? That was yesterday the case, right? And so on. So I do think it's still one of the dominant drivers. And we can also talk about what is actually driving flows, because we did an interesting research piece more recently. But we can talk about catalysts as well, macro catalysts.
Yeah. No, it would be interesting to talk about what is driving these flows. I mean, just one comment, one thing that I saw yesterday is, you know, when you look at the 13F filings, you know, that were published just recently, where you can look into like institutions and you get a glimpse of who's actually holding the ETFs, you know, and mostly the IBIT or the one from Fidelity, or then yours, you know, Bitwise's ETF as well. I mean, like, from what I can see is that hedge funds, you know, they have de-risked like materially, and they've done so last quarter already. I would assume to some extent they might still be doing it this quarter. We'll see.
I don't know if there's so much left to the risk, because if you look at, for example, Brevan Howard, you know, the very famous hedge fund, I think they de-risked already by 85% something, you know, which is quite a lot, you know. So they kind of sold it probably into the sort of correction that came underway in October. And then if you look at the investment advisors and the sovereign wealth funds, I mean, they have been stacking, you know, like,
exactly.
And so even the endowments, I think some of them have put it on their balance sheet. So in some sense, that's still institutional adoption, which maybe needs to counteract all the hedge funds that are now selling out of their positions, also because the basis trade is not that present anymore. But yeah, it will be interesting to see how this develops. And I would assume this is exactly what we are talking about. You know, we want to have maybe more the advisory firms and the endowments and the sovereign wealth funds holding Bitcoin, because when you compare them to the hedge funds, they're not going to be that fleeting. You know, they want to hold it for the long term, whereas the hedge funds are really just playing that sort of asset to squeeze out the yield in that sense, right? Is that something that you guys are seeing as well with your products?
Yes, of course. That's one of the key observations, right? I think it was CF Benchmarks to put that study, right? That analyzed like different types of investors. And it's true, like hedge funds, de-risks, while investment advisors, sovereign wealth funds increased their holdings in Q4, right? Based on these 30 NAV filings, which is super interesting. But it also plays into this kind of narrative, which is actually true based on these data, right? That there's some kind of redistribution from like more speculative, short-termish kind of trading demand, right? Investor types towards more long-termish kind of investor types, like stronger hands, right? And so we do form this kind of base from, yeah, based on like stronger investor types, stronger holders. And by the way, what is driving these laws? Probably interesting in terms of hedge fund buying. We did an analysis. We analyzed first all kinds of different cross asset flows, right? Flows into SPY, TLT ETFs, right? Long term bond ETFs, S&P 500 ETFs, high yield bonds, gold ETFs, and so on. We also analyzed macro factors such as the VIX, DVOL, right? So Bitcoin's own implied vol, the MOVE index, right? Treasury vol. And we looked at financial conditions and also the basis rate, right? Because one of the key narratives or beliefs is a declining or compressing basis rate actually leads to net outflows from Bitcoin ETFs, because especially hedge funds, they tend to benefit from like higher basis rate. Becomes more attractive, right, to play like delta neutral trades, Bitcoin. But what we found out was there's definitely some correlation, right? And even in some cases, Granger causality, right? Not even correlation, but also causality, especially with respect to the basis and also financial conditions and VIX, like risk aversion in equities. But the moment you build a model that is based on Bitcoin's past performance itself and past flows and all include all of these variables, including the basis rate, including the VIX, including DVOL, including MOVE index, and so on. And what happens is all of these other variables become insignificant. And only flows itself and Bitcoin's past performance remain significant. That means, so there are two aspects. So flows follow flows and flows follows performance.
Yeah.
So these are like the two aspects.
It's very reflexive in that sense.
It's very reflexive, right? It's like very pro-cyclical, but there's also persistence in flows, right? Which can be explained by a structural adoption, right? You tend to see like very structural inflows in some products, especially. Right. Which can be explained by ongoing institutional adoption, right? Such as investment advisors, right? But it's also pro-cyclical. There's also cyclical nature when you see like a risk aversion rising. And then, of course, like you have like periods of negative flows and also periods of deposit loss.
But to your point, I mean, it's very good that we're seeing these structural flows persist, you know, because like for you and me, maybe as hard die Bitcoiners, you know, we're not questioning the asset, you know, we're brainwashed enough, I would say, to be kind of Bitcoin maxis at this point, you know, and just see it going up again in the future. But that's what something I recognized from talking to friends at the bank that I work with, or other colleagues, you know, who are not that deep in Bitcoin itself, you know, they're now again really questioning the asset, you know, and they're like, obviously, well, 50%, it has come down. Might it go to zero now? Quantum computing, is it a risk, you know? But then when you can point to these sort of flows, you say, look, there are institutions that are still buying in, you know, that to me is sort of an argument why they're, it's not going to zero. You know, some people are still holding it. Some want to use this opportunity among the retailers, but then also among institutions. And I think for us, this might be something which we take for granted, but for these people, it's maybe something that reassures them. And they're like, okay, yeah, that's actually true. It's these institutions that are buying. So it might not go to CO after all, you know? So,
yeah, it's actually, I mean, this kind of social proof is so powerful, right? The fact that BlackRock, Fidelity, even Vanguard is now promoting Bitcoin ETFs, right? The fact that central banks like the Czech National Bank has been buying, Luxembourgish sovereign wealth fund, UAE sovereign wealth fund, right, has been buying. It's like it reinforces this kind of case, investment case for even bigger players, right, and so on, U.S. government and so on. Yeah, it's very powerful in terms of adoption. I think, yeah, what you usually see during a bear market is, you've probably seen this kind of chart about Google Trends, right? That like, I was Bitcoin dead, right? I think it's just reached a new all-time high. Like Google search trend is Bitcoin dead, right? That's like, these are like typical signs for a bottom, right? For a cyclical bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not dead, right? We can talk about different kinds of risks, such as quantum, right? Mm-hmm. That do expose Bitcoin to some risks, right? More or less. I think it's more about the timeline, though. So my TLDR on quantum risk, it's definitely farther away than most people believe, right? Which is why the quantum discount shouldn't be that high in the present. Because I think even if Bitcoin followed, and these quantum computers followed a Nevin's law, which is quite aggressive. So you have like a doubling in efficiency every year, right? But you still need to go from around 1,000 qubits, physical qubits, to a million qubits for Bitcoin to be vulnerable to quantum, right? That implies like 9 doublings, right? At least 9 years, even if you followed a Nevin's law, right? Some experts say it's nearer, but I think based on these kind of thoughts, I think it's actually farther away. But even if you assume it's 5 years away only, right, and you expose the whole supply of Bitcoin to quantum, not only these inactive coins like Satoshi wallets, but let's assume you expose the whole supply to quantum over the next 5 years, because they won't move quickly enough towards like quantum resistant addresses. Right, that so you need, for instance, you need to apply a discount of like, let's say 20% each year, right, in 5 years. And so what you could argue the current discount, quantum discount, 30%, right, based on the relative performance between Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, because Bitcoin Cash, yeah, is already moving towards quantum resistant addresses, I think, in May. So they have a way more aggressive roadmap. You could argue, okay, this kind of underperformance since Q4, somewhat a quantum discount of 30%. But so we essentially front ran like 1.5 years of quantum discount in like 5 months, which is very typical, like for financial markets to overreact to any kind of risk. And yeah, even if you assume a very aggressive kind of timeline for Q day, I think even in the short term, it for me personally, it's more of a like, it's more of an overreaction.
Interesting. I didn't know about Bitcoin Cash, that they're moving to quantum resistant algorithm, which is sort of a good test bed again. You know, Litecoin, Bitcoin Cash, all these other cryptos have always been a test bed and the sort of a toolkit sandbox for to try things out. So that's good to hear, because to me, obviously, I am way not advanced enough to give a sort of a qualified opinion on this. I'm just listening to people like you and others, you know, telling me things. And I feel like, yeah, to me, perception makes reality, you know, and people like me who are in Bitcoin but might be underqualified to really give a great guesstimation or a guess where this is going. I mean, they're somewhat worried deep down inside. And I feel like that's why perception makes reality, and it makes sense for people who, or for the Bitcoin ecosystem as such, you know, to try to solve this sooner than rather, but without rushing it, you know. And I feel like from what I can tell, talking to some people, it is a topic now. It probably helps that, you know, there's FUD in a bear market where it's maybe overshooting, as you said, you know, people are way more concerned that they should be, but that kind of gets the whole thing going, you know, and gets the ball rolling on in terms of fixing it. And so, yeah, I guess if I zoom out again, I'm not really worried, as probably you aren't either. So it's good to know, right? Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, but the cool thing, or on the bright side of quantum risk, is so it seems to be an overreaction in the short term, most likely in the medium to long term. So I think it's mostly priced in at this point, right? And also creates this kind of asymmetry, because if Bitcoin implemented quantum resistant addresses in 2026 already, right, we will probably close that discount in an instant, right? Almost instantly, which implies already 50% upside just by closing this kind of quantum discount, just hypothetically speaking, right? And at the same time, in terms of the macro, right, what quantum and all these like events like 1010 and so created, is we are seeing the biggest macro discount on record for Bitcoin. And you can actually measure like how Bitcoin is pricing the global growth outlook and so on based on quantitative methods. And we're seeing it's more than two standard deviations to the downside. That means, let's assume you're worried about not only quantum, but also like the global macroeconomy, right? You think AI is exposing US economy, especially to certain risks, right? Downside risks in terms of employment, right? So recession risks are increasing, and Bitcoin might be this kind of canary in the coal mine, right? That is pricing a kind of recession, that is kind of pricing tightening financial conditions. Even if that was the case, because we've already created such a big discount, I think it's mostly reflected, which also speaks and plays into this kind of asymmetry, you know.
That's an interesting point. I want to come to the macro now. I mean, maybe tying up this loose end, you know, so you're telling me that if this theory was correct, you know, and Bitcoin is sort of front running a potential recession in the real economy, in equity markets, and equity markets were to go down 25% to 30%, Bitcoin wouldn't move that violently again, or because a lot of it is already priced. Because exactly. I feel a lot of people have the feeling that if equity markets were to price 25% lower, Bitcoin would lose tremendously, you know. And you're now telling me, no, probably that might not be the case, because a lot of the downside has already happened and is behind us. Is there like statistical significance to this? Because I see all other people do some analysis and they're pointing to correlation with S&P and NASDAQ, and they're telling me, okay, Bitcoin is amplifying these moves. And so if we were to see this, I mean, Bitcoin would still correct, and then we could end up seeing Bitcoin prices of 35 or 25,000 or whatever. So yeah, any thoughts to this?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the correlation between the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 and Bitcoin still remains high, right, on a rolling basis. But what you can also see during like big equity market corrections is Bitcoin tends to front run these corrections, right? Tends to move lower before these major corrections in equities. So I do think in that kind of scenario, let's say we did see such a big drawdown in equity, such as during COVID, right? then of course Bitcoin will probably retrace even a bit more. But I think in terms of the beta, it will probably be below one, right? And although it will be correlated to the downside as well, positively correlated, but because there's so much priced in already, I do think that the downside is more limited than for equities even at this point, you know. But that being said, it's not my base case that we'll see some kind of market crash. I think what we're seeing right now is, at least not this year, right? Maybe in the future. I don't think we'll see a big kind of US equity market correction this year, despite AI, doomerism, and so on. But I think what we're seeing right now is a kind of rotation. You know, rotation out of tech equities, rotation out of growth equities into value, more like commodity sensitive sectors, cyclicals, right? From US to non-US, right? Such as European defense, emerging markets, and so on. I mean, these kind of rotations, they're usually not smooth, right? So you see downside in software, right? You see in all kinds of growth tech, you see downside. But at the same time, stock markets like MSCI World outside of the US, right? Developed markets are rallying to new all-time highs, right? And emerging markets the same. If you look at specific markets, they're rallying like crazy because they're all exposed to this more kind of cyclical commodity complex and so on. And my macro thesis is the reason why you saw this massive run in precious metals, but also other commodities like industrial metals, and now you're starting to see it in energy as well. The reason why you're seeing this is, it's not because like the US economy is roaring like crazy. It's because the Chinese economy is reflating again. If you look at the Chinese credit impulse, it tends to lead the commodity complex, especially industrial metals, by around 9 months. And we saw this kind of run up since essentially 2025, when the Chinese credit impulse reaccelerated. Which still implies and perfectly makes sense with this kind of run in commodity prices. And usually, why is it important for Bitcoin? It's important for Bitcoin because usually these kind of reflation cycles in industrial metals, like macro sensitive commodities, it tends to coincide with Bitcoin bull markets, right? That's why I'm also still relatively bullish, because one, you have this record macro discount, a discount of global growth expectations based on like even more forward-looking surveys than the ISM, right? And we know the ISM is re-accelerating, right? Plus, you have this impulse from China, which I don't think is completely priced in or priced in into Bitcoin at all, right? Because it's so depressed, maybe because of quantum, long-term holder setting, right? More idiosyncratic things, you know?
Yeah, it's a very interesting theory. I mean, in the end, when I talk to my macro colleagues, you know, from TradFi, they're not analyzing Bitcoin in terms of the four-year cycle as we did in the beginning. They're just telling me, okay, currently it's not Bitcoin's time. You know, as you said, software corrected, and that's why Bitcoin was dragged along. And then it's also general uncertainty, you know, because of like markets still, geopolitical risks, you know, and Bitcoin is a risk on assets still, you know. We can see it in the correlations, and that's why money is moving elsewhere. You know, it's going to AI still, or it's going to global defensives or global industrials, like these cyclical stocks, you know, that are sort of reflating because of what you just explained around the commodities, and then also because of the defense spending that's happening out of Europe and stuff like this. So this kind of makes intuitive sense to me as well, that it's just not Bitcoin's time, you know, and risk appetite is somewhere else. But then in terms of the macro, one thing that I've been following is also like these fiscal flows out of the US, you know, and this is where I've been following some of the MMT guys, you know, which I like to kind of challenge my own thesis. And they're sort of very skeptical still because of the tariffs, you know, that are in place, you know, and we had this legal, the Supreme Court striking down the tariffs, but then Trump was sort of backpedaling and saying, well, I'll bring more tariffs even. And they are worried that this could be even more destructive, you know, and they're arguing tariffs are essentially are a tax, you know, on private market wealth, which is withdrawn from private markets. And so they are seeing fiscal flows deteriorating, and that's why they're not bullish. They're saying, okay, Bitcoin is very tightly correlated with fiscal flows in the US, and that's why their argument is more the reinflating cycle or the business cycle, we're already at the eighth inning, so it's towards the end, and we're not at the beginning of one. And so I think that's, for me also, I can't make up my mind which theory is correct, but that's exactly the two theories. Are we at the beginning of a new business cycle, or are we towards the end? As of now, I lean more towards the second theory, but I feel like you believe in more of the third theory. If we kind of can we tell a first theory? But yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, the key question is whether, like, global money supply, global liquidity has peaked, right? It's, I mean, Bitcoin has become somewhat of a US-centric asset, which might imply, okay, fiscal spending in US is very important, right, and so on. But even if you look at US money supply growth, it's somewhat flatlined, but it's still growing, right, around 5% year over year, and 2 months supply growth, right? And yeah. I'd argue it will continue to reaccelerate. It will grow. It will continue to grow at least at this clip or even higher, because there are leading indicators for US money supply growth as well, such as the yield curve, right, continues to steepen. The change in the 10-year yield itself also implies that US money supply growth won't fall off a cliff anytime soon. But if you assume, okay, it's not such a US-centric asset, it's more like a global asset. But if you look at global money supply, it continues to make new all-time highs because of this Chinese reflation, right? It continues to grow at like 10%+ year over year. And it's not falling off the cliff anytime soon either, right?
Yeah.
So I don't believe in this. Like Michael Howell, he tends to say like, we've reached peak liquidity. Like, what does it even mean? Like gold money supply continues to make new all-time highs every day, but it's still growing at 10%+ year over year, right? Even if you look at central bank balance sheets, right? So not M2 money supply, but you look at like the G5 central bank. So including the Fed, including the ECB, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, right? It's not growing strongly, but it's not contracting either, right? Around 1 ±0%, but not like we've seen, for instance, 2022. Right, or 2019, where we had like contractions in both like central bank liquidity growth and global money supply, right, which were totally consistent with the Bitcoin bear market, by the way. But we don't see anything like this, right? Global money supply continues to grow at like double digit speed. Central bank balance sheets are like stalling, but they're not contracting either.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't believe in this kind of peak liquidity thesis right now.
I want to get Michael back onto my show as well and ask him exactly these type of questions, because yeah, as you're pointing to, I mean, the private banks are sort of reflating, you know, interest rates might currently be stuck, but I mean, we're still, I think markets are pricing in 2 more cuts in the US, so that would sort of also give more leeway for more liquidity than central balance sheets are expanding. Yeah, I want to ask him, how is he coming to the conclusion? Obviously, I know he's looking at all sorts of balance sheets, you know, and other types of things. It's not just looking at the money supply in and of itself, but then, yeah, how does he arrive at this idea that it's been peaking? But I mean, one point that I wanted to bring up is really the Bitcoinization or the Americanization of Bitcoin, you know, because that's something I've been pondering as well. I think I had a post sometime last year as well, where I was sort of ringing the alarm bell, but was kind of like, okay, the whole Trump saga and everything with the ETFs, has Bitcoin kind of, at least in the eyes of investors, Americanized, you know, and that's why it might be somewhat of a drag as well.
just because you know it, you're from Europe managing money. If you were invested into US equities even last year, I mean, because of dollar devaluation, you were 10 to 15% lower just because of the dollar, you know? And because Bitcoin is so dollar driven, this could also weigh on some of the people's willingness to invest into Bitcoin. That's at least what I'm hearing, that they're telling me, well, I do go into Bitcoin, but then it's so correlated to the US dollar as well. It seems somewhat Americanized, and that's why I want to stay off. So yeah, I see this as a problem, because like logically, as you said, it's a global asset still. Bitcoin, it's global, you know, but its perception seems to be very Americanized, maybe because of Trump. And so my last thought would be maybe Trump wasn't that net positive for Bitcoin after all, but that's maybe a whole other discussion. But yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, it's true. I do think there's definitely some kind of Americanization of Bitcoin, right? Because if you look at the biggest sovereign, right? It's the US government. The biggest sovereign Bitcoin holder worldwide, right?
Yeah.
At least that we know of, public information, based on public information.
Yeah. Right. The biggest private company is
exactly
also US.
Biggest private company, MSTR, biggest ETF, right? iShares, FBTC, Fidelity's one, right? Then biggest public miners, at least, right? Riot, Marathon, and so on. So you could definitely make the case that is that that's some kind of Americanization. And if you look at what is usually driving, which kind of jurisdiction tends to drive Bitcoin's performance, it tends to be Coinbase, right? The Coinbase exchange and or U.S. trading hours most of the time, especially because of ETF buying and so on. And
Isn't it Chain Street that's driving the Bitcoin price? No,
that's another question. But I think, by the way, talking about Chain Street, I think the whole there's so much noise on Twitter, right? That's why it's good to have shows like this, right? Separate the noise from the signal, right?
Yeah.
And there are two things, right? First, I personally don't believe there's ever been like a 10 a.m. slam, because if you look at the intraday performance of Bitcoin, and like really on 5-minute intervals, tick by tick basis, essentially, and you check US trading hours. Since I've actually done analysis, I've just posted the chart yesterday. Since January 2024, since the ETFs started trading, you can see there wasn't any kind of significant downside during 10 a.m. Most of the downside occurred outside of U.S. trading hours, right? So you could say, okay, it was some kind of midnight Asia slam or anything, but there's no such thing as a 10 a.m. slam. And the second thing I want to point out, like the whole Bitcoin Twitter went crazy over. I mean, there are definitely allegations around Terra Luna, right? And so on, Jane Street's involvement. But that's a different story, right? And there are also some allegations around 1010 momentum ignition, potential alleged momentum ignition by market makers, right? But I don't think there's like a systematic kind of manipulation going on, long-term kind of manipulation going on. Maybe there's some kind of hints for like short-term manipulation. But by the way, what was also funny, why the whole Bitcoin Twitter freaked out was, Jane Street, they deleted all their tweets, right, on Twitter, right? But if you just do a simple like grok prompt and ask like, did they ever post something? Grok will say, no, they didn't ever post anything.
You can also check the Wayback Machine. Yeah,
exactly. You can check the Wayback. And also if you do, you'll notice they never tweeted anything, right? They didn't delete anything. They never tweeted anything in the first place. But like they're so, I think the market's hungry. I don't know why, but like the market's hungry for some kind of conspiracy. And which might be true in some like singular cases, but not structurally, right? Not over the long term.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, to the
10 a.m. dump or sell-off case. You know, I saw some other data that people are sharing and they came to the conclusion in the end, it's just because there's at this time, there's this overlap of Asia hours, Europe hours, US hours. And that's why volatility is usually higher. But higher volatility doesn't automatically mean manipulation, you know. And so they came to this sort of conclusion. And as you said, they didn't see any significant sort of correlation that there is really manipulation going on by Jane Street. And as you said it yourself, I mean, in the end, the market really seems to be looking for a scapegoat. They want to blame somebody. They want to rage quit. It almost seems like, okay, this is why, and now we're down. And this to me is then another sort of indicator where I say, well, the bottom is probably close just because people are so stressed out and kind of pissed, you know, and they're looking for any sort of excuse why this is the case. So, usually these things really tell you stuff about the market, which I like to follow. And as you said, with Bitcoin, that's one thing that I grew sort of weary of, you know, because a lot of Bitcoiners they're really prone to believing these narratives. And that's why we started the show, you know, to hopefully kind of separate the noise from the signal and just focus on the signal. But you're right. I mean, it's good to have people like you and others who can kind of help with that. That's for sure.
Yeah, most definitely. I think what's also interesting with maybe one last point on the Americanization is I do think there's a case to be made for especially US consumers, US retail being one of the dominant forces in Bitcoin and crypto markets. There's a funny correlation between US consumer sentiment and crypto sentiment, right? So macro consumer sentiment as measured by the University of Michigan consumer expectations, right? And the crypto fear and greed index. It's actually quite funny, but if the crypto fear and greed index even leads this kind of consumer sentiment, but that's a very high correlation. And so based on this kind of observation, you could make the case that since consumer sentiment is so depressed because of structural themes, right? Labor market issues and so on, you'll probably see like sluggish demand for crypto assets, for Bitcoin and so on. But at the moment you see a reversal in consumer sentiment, it should provide like an extreme tailwind, right, for sentiment overall. But that's outside of the whole like institutional story. That's just retail. Because what we've seen so far, essentially during the whole cycle, right, since 2023, since the bull market began, like retail has been mostly absent, right? There's not been a lot of retail participation. And I think the weakness in the US labor market, the weakness in the US consumer sentiment, issue belief in this kind of Americanization, which is somewhat true, right, could be one of the key kind of reasons for this, right?
Yeah, I saw a post by Wintermute, another market maker, you know, who's analyzed exactly this, where is retail gone? And they came to the conclusion that it's mostly they've gone to other equities, you know, because there it's easier to value the stuff and you get some more information, whereas with crypto it's all just sentiment, and once the sentiment is depressed, it's really hard to get it up without like significant sort of changes in the underlying structure, as you just said, you know. And that's why a lot of people feel like, okay, now that the narratives are all dead, I mean, I can't really revive them, and that's why I'm going to look for other things to do. And that's why more and more people are probably speculating on AI stocks or whatever. And so that was just an interesting analysis as well. But maybe to close things off, I'd like to ask you, we've talked about some narratives, the one that you mentioned, you know, like once Bitcoin is quantum proof, I mean, it could be a great narrative and it would also help to discount sort of close the discount that's maybe here because of quantum. I know usually price moves first and then we come up with narratives, but what do you think, if we look ahead, what could be some interesting narratives that gets Bitcoin going again, you know, in the future? Will it be that AI agents will be using Bitcoin, at least the open source ones, or what other narratives that we might not be able to think of right now are you seeing on the horizons? Anything that you can share with us?
Yeah, the AI agent story is definitely one of these great ones, right? Positive great ones, right? I think many experts, including myself, thought this was farther away, right? Farther away in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at growth in AI agents, it's incredible. It's, I think, even higher than exponential, right? There are already, I think, millions of AI agents on Moltbook, right? Right now. And I think it just a couple of months ago was zero, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's millions and millions and growing fast. And so what it does is essentially, and there was an interesting tweet by, I think it was Ralph Paul, but he said, like, we always believe the TAM, the total addressable market for Bitcoin, is just like the human population, right? Around 8 billion max adoption that you can reach, right? 100% adoption. If you look at adult populations, way low, it's probably just 6 billion, right? And then developed markets. But we always thought it was the human population only, right? That suddenly, I mean, the agentic population, AI population, can be so much bigger, right? Can be 2x, 5x the human population, right? So suddenly this kind of potential TAM increases massively, right, for Bitcoin adoption. Because if you ask any kind of AI, right, and you've probably seen thousands of posts about this, if you ask any kind of AI, what's your preferred kind of currency, right? Your medium of exchange and so on. Without any kind of explanation, just one word, Bitcoin, right? If you ask Gemini, Bitcoin. If you ask ChatGPT, Bitcoin, right? Code, Bitcoin. So apparently there's some kind of preference for Bitcoin, most likely because it's permissionless, right? They don't need any kind of permissions to create a wallet and mm-hmm. receive Bitcoins, right? And also send Bitcoins. The transactions cannot be censored. It's the best store value, right, in the digital space. And so, yeah, that could be an interesting wild card. I don't have like any kind of expectation because it can be totally wild. But yeah.
In terms of narratives, it will probably be something we can't even think of right now. And that's why it will only be obvious in hindsight, you know, like, oh, yeah, exactly, this is it. But like the AI one, I'm so curious, you know, because there it's similar to quantum. I'm not proficient enough to kind of judge, it sounds very intuitive when you're telling me this, you know, like, yeah, AIs will use Bitcoin because of the permissionlessness. But then I feel like down in the nitty gritty stuff is probably more complicated. You also sometimes hear the argument AIs can't open a bank account, you know, because they have no persona. But then I feel like, yeah, but what about stable coins and maybe still there's always still somewhat of a human behind an AI and he may be pushing it in a certain direction. So I want to talk to some expert on this as well to kind of really figure out how can we make sure, you know, at least like open source agents will be using open source money. So it will be interesting, but there's a lot more to come. So things are developing fast.
The most right. hilarious thing that I've seen is there are actually other AI agents that are now orange pilling others on Moltbook, which is somewhat hilarious. But I think apart from the AI agent story, I think one of the key catalysts will be these wirehouse approvals, right? I don't think we have seen like significant inflows, right? From into ETFs from essentially the big banks, right? Bank of America, Wells Fargo, that just approved these products in Q4. So if you look at the ETF, we've seen net outflows, right? From ETFs this year. And also with respect to treasury companies, it's been MSCR only, right? It's just been, I think they bought more than any company combined, right? Even more than all ETFs combined this year. I think close to 47,000 Bitcoins, right?
Yeah.
Which is incredible. So it's been MSCR only, but we still haven't seen significant buying from these newer treasury companies like BSCR, right? Like 21 and so on. I think that will come in 2026 and could like increase competition. Although like Michael Saylor doesn't want to hear that word, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that could increase like buying and accelerate competition among treasury companies, broadening of this kind of buying power. And yeah, wirehouses, treasury company buying, I think these could be like the catalysts as well.
Interesting. Yeah, Andre, I think we've gone over an hour. So thanks a lot for sharing your insights with us. Maybe just quickly again, where can people find you when they want to connect?
Yes, of course. So I'm very active on Twitter. You can find me with Andre_Dragos. I'm not so active on Nostr, but yeah, maybe
as we should be.
Yeah, I should be. You can also find my book. It's on Amazon. I've published a book called Exponential Gold. You can see it in the background. It's an institutional investor's guide for Bitcoin and crypto assets. And yeah, you can find it on Amazon or exponential-gold.com.
Nice. Yeah. Thanks a lot for taking the time. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your day. And also thanks for making it happen. You were the first person, as I said, and when I started the show, and it's great to have you back. And in the future, we'll be talking again.
Yes. Thank you, Pascal. Yeah, it was a real pleasure. And congratulations on the show again.
Thank you. Bye, Andre.
Bye.